NYC.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Well, coming up, some practical ideas about how to reduce gun violence in the U.S. But first, one listener comment about yesterday's program. Part of the discussion yesterday was about President Trump's announcement that he would not debate his Republican opponents before the upcoming presidential primaries. Here's what one listener had to say.
Hi, this is Marcia Ree from Tampa. And if I were to try to coerce Trump into debating, if I was a conservative trying to give him an argument as to why he should debate the other Republicans going against him, I would simply tell him that it makes him look weak not to debate them and ask what he's afraid of. That right there would get a reaction immediately. Thanks.
There's a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. Well, in recent years, there have been dozens of mass shootings in the U.S. involving the deaths of four or more people. Semi-automatic weapons were the weapons of choice by most of the killers. By far, most of the weapons were legally obtained. So far, neither Congress nor Tallahassee have taken much action to reduce gun violence. We're going to discuss some possible remedies with Igor Volsky. He's the co-founder and executive director of Guns Down America. That's an organization dedicated to building a future with fewer guns. He made headlines in 2015 for shaming lawmakers who took money from the NRA and then sent thoughts and prayers after mass shootings. He'll be speaking in Tampa next Tuesday and Wednesday. More on that in a moment. But let me start by saying, Igor Volsky, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Igor, tell me about Guns Down America. How did you decide to start this organization?
Well, so I started the organization in 2016 in the aftermath of the Pulse shooting with the realization that in order for us to be successful in building safer communities, we needed to be bolder in what we're asking for, and we also needed a clear long-term goal. And for us, that goal is building a future with fewer guns and making those guns harder to get. And we run advocacy campaigns to help make that possible, but also help move the Overton window on how we talk about gun violence reduction and gun safety.
You have a 10-point plan that you say that our founding fathers would embrace. First of all, let me ask you about the Second Amendment. What does the Second Amendment mean to you?
Well, the Second Amendment is a right to own a firearm, but it also connotates a sense of responsibility, a well-regulated militia. In fact, you see that sentiment within the body of our Constitution, where there's a right, there's a responsibility. And we're arguing that people who choose to own guns should be able to prove to their community, to their neighbors, that they could do so responsibly. They should get a license. They should register their firearm. They should take out insurance. And we know that those kinds of reforms work in reducing gun homicide and gun suicide. They've worked here domestically in the states that have adopted those reforms, but also internationally in countries around the world that have successfully tackled this problem.
So you don't believe that the Second Amendment is there to, we've had some callers to this show even say that it's there to protect somebody in their home if the government gets too draconian. If the government turns against the people, it's a way for a person inside their home to defend themselves against a government that's gone wrong.
Well, look, Rob, I think realistically speaking, if the government were to turn draconian and if it goes wrong, as you say, it doesn't matter what kind of weapons you or I or anybody else has, the might of what the government has would simply be too great. So I don't foresee a future where we as a populace somehow take up arms to overthrow our government. That's just, to me, not a realistic proposition.
Our guest is Igor Volsky. He's the co-founder and executive director of a group called Guns Down America. He has a 10-point plan to reduce gun violence in the U.S. He'll be coming to Tampa next Tuesday and Wednesday and speaking in two places. We'll tell you more about that in a moment. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. You touched on those 10 ideas. Let's go through some of them. One is that you want to end gun manufacturer immunity from civil lawsuits and criminal prosecution. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I mean, they are really the only industry who knowingly produce incredibly dangerous weapons, who market those weapons in incredibly militant ways and using military-style language. And then when those weapons are frankly basically used as advertised by mass shooters all across the country, they wash their hands of it and say, well, it's the person and it's not the gun. And so you've seen all around the country lawsuits that individuals and families and communities have tried to bring against gun manufacturers for knowingly producing firearms and products without very basic either safety additions that could be added to make those guns less dangerous, or marketing those firearms in such a way that is very dangerous. So, for instance, the Bushmaster assault weapon was marketed as your man card reissued. And the actual assault weapon, if you got it shipped to you, came with a physical man card that you could show to your friends and family, I guess, that you're an actual man. So those are the kinds of things the industry does, as well as specifically target young children and women with their products. So they need to be held accountable for those kinds of actions, because there's no God-given right for the gun industry to profit from the consequences of what their products actually produce. But even beyond that, Rob, I think we need to have some kind of federal body that actually regulates the kinds of products that the firearm industry manufactures, because right now there's no federal body that sets any kind of safety standards for the weapons that the industry can sell to civilians. And that's why those weapons have gotten increasingly more lethal over the last several years.
But the comeback would be, look, if Ford manufactures a car and somebody drives their car into a crowd of people, the Ford didn't cause that driver to drive into a crowd of people and kill them. Ford just manufactured a car, and when it's used correctly, the car is a great thing.
But if Ford manufactured the car with some kind of device or some kind of element of that car that they knew, for instance, made it more difficult for people to slam on the brakes, to use your example, in that crowd, if they knew that that was a deficiency, that they could easily fix it by putting, for instance, a more expensive piece or a more expensive piece of technology into their car to prevent that from happening, and they chose not to, they could be held accountable in the court of law. That's not always clear with the gun industry. There are some instances where they could, but we know that since that liability protection went into place, lots of judges have blocked attempts by family members and communities to hold the industry accountable. It's all based on the theory that you produce your product for the worst case scenario, not for the best case scenario. And that's a basic theory of liability that simply doesn't exist when we talk about the gun industry.
Well, we're talking with Igor Volsky. He's co-founder and executive director of a group called Guns Down America. He'll be speaking at a League of Women Voters luncheon next Tuesday at the Columbia in Tampa, and he'll be speaking at the Oxford Exchange next Wednesday. And this is 88.5 FM. So you mentioned safety. Are there ways? We just had a case in Tallahassee where a young man, a teenager, was showing a gun to his sister and his sister's friend, and the gun accidentally went off, killed the sister with a shot to the head. And apparently it wasn't this guy's gun, or he didn't know how to handle it. But this happens all the time, where there's an accidental yeah. shooting, somebody dies. Are there ways to make guns safer, and what are the ways that you would like to see guns made safer?
Well, look, first of all, children should never have access to their parents' firearms. So those firearms need to be stored, and they need to be stored safely, and they need to be locked away, and that gun should probably have a trigger lock on it. Those are the kinds of fairly basic reforms that could save a lot of lives, particularly the lives of our children. And I think, frankly, it gets to a larger point of our low standard for gun ownership in America. And of course, part of the argument that I make and part of the 10-point plan I lay out in the book Guns Down is what we have to do to raise the standard for gun ownership in America, to raise the standard for gun production in America in order to build safer communities.
So is it possible right now to make a gun that only fires with the fingerprints or handprint of the owner of the gun?
So there's some smart gun technology that would allow for that. It does seem, though, that that technology is still in its early stages. So I think certainly eventually we'll get to a place where those kinds of smart guns will be more commonplace. But frankly, the larger concern is the fact that we have 393 million firearms in civilian hands in America. That's more guns than people. Those guns are entirely unaccounted for and are floating around in our society. And clearly, given the high rates of everyday gun violence and mass shootings, we as a country need to figure out how we're going to deal with that problem. And, you know, maybe at the same time, think about the smart gun technology. But the guns already in circulation that are not smart guns pose a serious threat.
One of your 10 ideas is to require insurance of all gun owners, like we require car insurance. How would that work?
Well, it would work in a way that really raises the standard of gun ownership. So one of the things that I advocate for in the book is if you're going to own a gun, if you choose to be a gun owner, you should get a license in the same way that you need a license to drive a car. So in my example, and this is the case in Massachusetts, you would go to a local police station, you would get fingerprinted, there would be a written test, there would be a field test, there would be a much more comprehensive background check that you would have to go through that contact more databases than just the NICS federal database, which we know is wholly inadequate. There would be a waiting period, and then if you jump through all of those hoops, you would get a license. And you could purchase the firearm. I would add another provision to that kind of system of requiring individuals to have insurance if they decide to become gun owners. And what that would say is that, look, you are buying a device that's specifically designed to kill people. And this device and guns in general have a real economic cost on society. I think estimated about $258 billion annually of both direct and indirect costs from gun deaths in America, from the 40,000 annual gun deaths in America. And the argument would be that gun owners have to have some responsibility in bearing the burden of that cost.
Would a regular insurance company, a for-profit insurance company, write an insurance policy like that, do you think?
Well, I think what we would need is broader systemic reform. So if you're going to put into place a new law that would establish a federal licensing system in the country, that would probably be implemented and driven by the states, so states could design and implement their licensing systems. You would probably need some kind of requirement, I'd imagine, to for insurers to now get into that business.
The cost to the public, I'm wondering, you know, after, let's say, for instance, the shooting at that country music concert in Las Vegas a few years ago where so many people were gunned down and so many people were wounded. I wonder what percent of the cost of those injuries and those deaths, what percent of that is borne by the public? How much public cost is there to a mass shooting like that or like you mentioned Pulse a few years ago here in Florida? How much of the cost is put on the public?
Well, you know, I have not seen a breakdown of costs in terms of how much the public bears, how much businesses, local businesses in the area bear, how much the healthcare system bears in a mass shooting situation. But I'll tell you that what we know is that for a firearm suicide, and Rob, as you know, about two-thirds of gun deaths in America are firearm suicides, that every single death, when you count and average out lost income over a lifetime and lost productivity over a lifetime, is about $1 million per suicide. So as you can imagine, that really adds up, not to mention the emotional toll that a suicide takes on a family and on a community. So these costs, these economic costs, are very real and are certainly part of the argument for why we all have to do what we can to help build a future with fewer guns. But also businesses and large employers must also play a key role, particularly when you think about the economic consequences.
Yeah, because I would think that in the case of Pulse, for instance, probably some of those people had no health insurance who were killed or who were injured. So that cost is taken, given to the public hospital or the hospital that treats these people. They'll never recover that cost. And then you've got the cost of the ambulance, you've got the cost of the police, the overtime for police to do the investigation, and that took days and days and days. And then you've got the cost of the trial, any trials involved, if the shooter survives. The cost has to be enormous, and I wonder, you know, if somehow you could transfer the cost to the public to the people that own the guns.
Well, and that's precisely the theory behind having insurance when you own a gun, too. To have a system in which those costs, all the costs that you outlined, aren't simply pushed off to the public as they are now, but that there's a fund that's set up that all those insurance premiums go into, that you could then tap that fund to help individuals who have lifelong medical bills and medical issues and struggles as a result of being injured, and of course to communities as well that are recovering and that need to cover many of the costs that you outlined.
And in some cases, the buildings where these events took place, whether it's a school or a nightclub, they're torn down. So there's a cost to the owner of the building or to the public, too. Well, we're talking with Igor Volsky. He is the co-founder of a group called Guns Down America. That's also the name of his book. He'll be speaking in Tampa next Tuesday at a luncheon sponsored by the League of Women Voters of Hillsborough County. And he'll also be speaking at the Oxford Exchange for a book talk and signing at 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, September 18th. That's next Wednesday. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. His 10-point plan includes end gun manufacturer immunity from civil lawsuits and criminal prosecution, regulate and license gun dealers, increase oversight and regulation of gun manufacturers, prohibit the sale of semi-automatic weapons and high-capacity magazines to civilians, and provide financial and other incentives for people to give up their existing firearms. You know, I've heard people say to me, that, well, if we prohibit the sale of semi-automatic weapons and high-capacity magazines to the public, we're going to be giving up our civil liberties. When Australia did it a few years ago, what happened?
Well, when Australia, following a tragic massacre in 1996, came together with leadership from an incredibly conservative prime minister who in the days after the shooting, unveiled a sweeping package of reforms that tightened licensing standards for firearms, banned certain kind of military-style weapons, and unveiled a gun buyback program for certain kinds of guns. He traveled the country in selling that plan, and what he would tell Australians is, look, we love America. We love American culture, their music, their movies. But what we can't have as Australians is we can't import America's gun problem into Australia as well. And so that plan that I loosely described was quickly passed and implemented. Australia took some 500,000, I believe is the estimate, firearms off the street, particularly assault-style weapons. And since then, it hasn't suffered a single public mass shooting and saw both homicides and suicides fall. That, I think, is a prime example of what happens when you have leaders take bold stances that prioritize the lives and safety of their communities and that work strategically to help reduce the number of guns in circulation. And to some degree, I think, and I lay this out in the book, it could provide a roadmap for us to solve our problem as well.
And Australia, last time I looked, still is a very free democracy, and it was a conservative government that put that in place?
Yes, it was a Prime Minister John Howard, who was very close to the Bush family and is probably one of the more conservative prime ministers that Australia had. They were able to really build a strong coalition that pushed all of these measures through. And yes, they are still fairly free. They just have a much lower rate of gun debt.
Just before we let you go, the last thing I want to ask you is about ending open carry. The folks that support open carry say you're much safer if a responsible gun owner is carrying a gun around a movie theater or a restaurant or out in public at a concert or a park, because the bad guys will know that there's a good guy with a gun there and that the good guy will be protecting all the unarmed people that are in that movie theater or in that park. What would you say back?
That's a fantasy, and it's not how the world actually works. What has often happened in instances where you have a so-called responsible gun owner with a firearm during a mass shooting situation is that once the police arrive, it's very difficult for them to ascertain who's the quote-unquote good guy and who's the quote-unquote bad guy. And we've had multiple instances of police after the fact tell us that these additional guns that were at the scene actually posed a greater risk both to them and to innocent individuals. And so if you look broadly at the numbers, the instances during which a individual with a gun stopped the mass shooting is almost non-existent. And that what is much more often the case is that it just adds to the chaos and to the panic, and that those individuals who don't have the kind of special training that our law enforcement officials have are wholly incapable of taking the kind of action that's necessary to defuse a real active shooter.
I think many people are familiar with shootouts in the movies where James Bond is able to use his pistol to shoot people at 100 yards away, and there's never any chaos. It's all very orchestrated in the movies, whether it's a Western or anything else, but that is not the way that shootings happen in real life.
It's not, and you know, we've had FBI reports analyze these kinds of instances, and they found, again, that this notion that a so-called responsible person with a gun can stop a mass shooting situation is almost non-existent. Given the dynamics and the chaos that are at play, you really need to have special training that you refresh and undergo very frequently in order to be an effective responder in that moment.
Igor, we have 15 or 20 emails, but I just want to ask you one of these email questions. It comes from Ernie. He says, I generally agree with the concept of higher standards for gun ownership. I would like to know your guests' knowledge and experience with firearms.
Well, I open my book with my experience of taking a really intensive two-day course on handguns and learning both the laws around them and how to properly shoot them and all of that. And I've shot guns in the past. But look, frankly, I am not a current gun owner. And so my experience is fairly limited, although I've done my best to really familiarize myself with guns and with gun culture. But I'll just say that all of us, gun owners and non-gun owners, face a real threat from the 393 million guns in civilian hands. And I think it's up to all of us to come together and fight this fight. And I think, you know, I firmly believe that most people who own guns in America are, in fact, responsible gun owners. And that's why I'm heartened to hear from your audience from that email that they agree with raising the standard for gun ownership. And I think most gun owners do think that you should have a license, that you should register your gun, because those are reforms that will keep all of us safe, both gun owners and non-gun owners alike.
Igor Volsky, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. What's the website for your group?
It's gunsdownamerica.org.
Igor, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks. That's Igor Volsky of Guns Down America, and he'll be coming to Tampa next week. He'll be speaking twice. He'll be speaking at a League of Women Voters event at noon at the Columbia Restaurant next Tuesday, and you can find out more at hclwv.org. And he'll also be speaking at the Oxford Exchange for a book talk and signing at 6:30 in the evening next Wednesday. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lori. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to change topics right now and tell you about something that's happening tonight in Tampa. A group hoping to raise the minimum wage in the state is holding a meeting tonight in Tampa. It'll be at the IBEW Hall on East Chelsea Street in Tampa. The group is called Fight for 15. One of the speakers there will be Jeremy Greer, who's co-founder of a group called Liberation in a Generation. And we'll talk about how to change the existing economy and replace it with a liberation economy. I found out what he meant by that when I spoke with him yesterday. Jeremy Greer, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So when you say liberation economy, what do you mean?
Yeah, we're talking about a liberation economy. We're talking about an economy that does four basic things. And there are really four basic things that have been really held back from a lot of communities of color. When I talk about communities of color, we're talking about African-American communities, Latinx communities, immigrant Asian communities, and indigenous communities. And a liberation economy should provide four basic things. It should provide enough income so that people can meet their basic needs, food, shelter, clothing, that they have enough that they can feel safe and secure in their own community. They have a roof over their head that is affordable to them, and they don't have to constantly worry about being put on the street, that they financially are secure, that they can ensure that if they interact with their bank, they're not going to be stripped of their wealth. The other thing that it provides, third thing is value, that when they work, that they're being honored and valued for the work that they do in the form of compensation. And this is where our partnership with the Fight for 15 here in Florida is so critical and important. And the last piece that's critically important is that they feel like they belong. That is, they belong, that they're a part of the economy, that they're instrumental to the success of the economy, and they're not held out on the fringes, that they're part of the mainstream. So those are really what we're talking about. We're talking about liberation economy.
And how do you achieve that? What's the path to get there?
I mean, it's really through public policy. We've had a history in this country where our public policy has been structured in a way that we have not allowed people of color to enjoy those four basic things. You know, from the time of chattel slavery, we have been exploiting the labor of African Americans. We've stolen land from indigenous people and really limited their ability to build wealth. And what we really need to do is restructure the economy from what we call an oppression economy that looks to exploit their labor, really take away the land and extract from them, and really exclude them from the mainstream to an economy that does that and that provides for that. So liberation economy, for example, would be that everyone that wants to work will have an opportunity to work through like a federal jobs guarantee that pays a basic minimum wage and provides benefits that if you aren't able to work, that you have access to basic income. That will, so that you can provide for those basic needs, that you can afford housing, that you can afford health care. So that's really the pathway to do that, is to restructure our public policy so that we move from an oppression economy that looks to hold people down to a liberation economy that allows people to thrive.
And you mentioned a minimum wage a moment ago, yeah. But my guess is that what you're saying is you don't really want the $8.50 an hour, whatever the prevailing minimum wage is right now. You want a living wage. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely fair to say. There's no way that anyone today can live off of a $8.25 minimum wage, which I believe is a minimum wage here in Florida. Everyone should have a basic minimum wage that's $15 an hour. And the minimum wage is a huge first step down the road of that liberation economy. Like I said, it is the first step in truly valuing the productivity and the work that workers provide into the economy by compensating them for that work, and in return they'll have the ability to take care of a lot of the basic needs that they need, and be able to move forward and thrive.
One of the other problems that's happening here in the Tampa Bay area and all over the country is that if you make that minimum wage, you can't afford housing.
Yeah.
And so how would you make housing more affordable?
Yeah, so one of the ways that you can make housing affordable is to provide a subsidy. You know, it's interesting is we only subsidize housing for the very, very poor and the very, very rich. And you're probably asking, how do we subsidize housing for the very, very rich? Well, we do it through our tax code. We provide a mortgage interest deduction to most homeowners in this country, and the people that benefited from it are people with the biggest and most expensive houses. So we actually provide a subsidy. Who doesn't get a subsidy for their housing are people who are kind of in the middle, those low-wage, minimum-wage workers that make about, you know, somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 a year and working 40 and 50 hours a week, and they own their home. They don't get any type of benefit. Or if you're a renter in that same income area, you don't get any subsidy. So what we'd argue for is let's provide a subsidy, either through the tax code or through other means, to working class folks who are paying more than 30% of their income for housing.
One of the things you point out, too, is that there's a structural problem. White males overall make more than Hispanic males or African-American males. That's kind of locked into our society across 50 states.
Yeah, I mean, I'll hit you with a national number that I think should really be shocking to a lot of people. So I don't know if you've heard of the racial wealth gap, but there's an enormous racial wealth gap in this country in which white households on average are have much more wealth than black and Latino households. In 2013, the median net worth for a white family was about $116,000. And the median net worth for an African-American family was $2,000. Actually, that's $2,000 of wealth that that family in 2013, African-American family had, is less than they had at the median in 1983. So wealth for African-Americans is actually going down. What's even more staggering is when you look at the combined wealth of the 400 richest Americans in our country, they have more wealth than the entire African American population and about two-thirds of the Latino population combined. So the huge gap in our society is that we have an economy that allows very wealthy people to gain more and more wealth. And what we do is we hold out largely people of color from partaking in this, the success of our economy by building wealth. And we have an enormous racial wealth gap that we have to close.
Our guest is Jeremy Greer. He's the co-founder of Liberation in a Generation, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So I imagine that that wealth gap largely is tied to the value of homes. If you own a home, you have more personal wealth than if you're a renter or you don't own a home. So is the key getting people who don't have homes into home ownership?
Well, that's one thing that can be done. Of course, there's no silver bullet to solve a huge problem like that, but home ownership is a huge step in the right direction. Just here in Florida, for example, about 44% of blacks own their homes and about 50% of Latino communities own their homes. That's compared to 74% of white families that own their homes. And then when those 44% of blacks and those 50% of Latinos own their homes, they tend to live in communities where the value of those homes is much less than it is for white communities. So yes, while there isn't a silver bullet, home ownership and moving people towards home ownership would be a huge step in the right direction. But what I'll add to that is that while home ownership would be a huge step, again, closing that wage gap would be another huge step. A recent statistic that was shared with me by the folks that are working on Fight for 15 here in Florida showed that the median wage for African Americans in Florida is around $15 an hour. That means half of African Americans, half of black people in Florida earn less than $15 an hour. So that would be so along with home ownership, closing that wage gap would be a huge step in the right direction.
And
as well.
And even at $15 an hour, you're barely scraping by.
Yeah.
All right. So you mentioned banks. One of the problems is that if you have a checking account and you don't maintain a certain balance, you get charged for having that checking account. Expensive to have a checking account. What would you do about banks and credit and storing money away and maybe payday lending? What would you do about all that?
Yeah, I mean, the financial service sector is a huge extractive kind of industry that really pulls a lot of the wealth out of black and brown communities. And it's this way today, but it's kind of always been that way. I mean, when you look back into the history of redlining, in which African-Americans could not get homes in certain parts of cities, you'd see what the financial institutions will come in. They will come with alternative products to give to those African-Americans looking to own homes. They were called deeds. They were called contract for deeds, and they were very extractive products that actually stripped a lot of the wealth away from black households. I'd say a parallel today is the payday industry. So a lot of black and Latino households, a lot of immigrant households are unable to get checking accounts from major banks or financial institutions, or able to get credit, small dollar credit from major banks and financial institutions, which really leads them no other choice but to look to payday loans and alternative credit products. And it's not because these people don't understand what they're getting into. It's just they don't have any other choice. So they go into these payday loans that pay, triple, double, tripling, almost six times at times, owing more money than they actually borrowed. And these payday loan places are in largely black and brown communities. They're storefront. You can just walk in, and then you can walk out with a loan. And the reason that the people are going there is because they're not allowed access to mainstream credit markets the way a lot of other people are. They're not allowed. They often don't have credit cards. They often don't have bank accounts and things like that.
All right. So how would you change that, though? So to make it so that people could obtain credit at a reasonable interest rate, or even if they have a small amount of money, make sure that the bank doesn't take it at the end of the month.
Yeah, we have to eliminate what we call the dual financial system. And that's that dual system where if you're a person of means, often white, you're able to access financial services through the mainstream, through retail banks, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Chase. But the other system is this one that we just talked about where there are alternative products because other people are not allowed access. I'm of the belief, and we're of the belief that all people should be able to access that mainstream financial market, that all people should have access to affordable checking, affordable savings accounts, affordable credit card accounts, affordable financial services so that they can take care of their family's needs, and that the bank should offer those without adding extracted fees that like nickel and dime them to death, you know, if you overdraft or if you make a mistake or things like that. Like, this should be a core tenet of financial services, which is why the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is a federal agency, is so important to make sure that the banks are in line and serving the needs of their consumers, and these consumers who have been exploited by the financial system especially.
What about other ideas beyond the private banking system, of like turning the post office into some sort of banking system?
Yeah.
Or public banks?
Yeah, I think a public option would be a really, really helpful option, particularly for people that are not banked by the mainstream, because one, it'll be backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. So, and the U.S. government really wouldn't have any incentive in exploiting people. And then two, I mean, you talk about postal banking. There may not be a bank in every community, but there is a post office in every community. And that could be a way that you can really get a lot of services out to people who are typically locked out of mainstream financial systems. And again, with products like checking, savings, credit cards, small dollar loans, even mortgages.
Well, our guest is Jeremy Greer, a co-founder of Liberation in a Generation, and we're talking about the ideas for a liberation economy. This is WMNF in Tampa. So, Jeremy, where did the idea of your group, Liberation in a Generation, come from, and how do you get the public policy ideas, how do you get these ideas passed, whether it's in the state legislature or city council or Congress? How are you working to achieve your goals?
Yeah, so I've been fortunate enough for a number of years. I myself and my colleague that's co-founder Solana Rice, in working with a lot of people around this issue of the racial wealth gap that we talked about a moment ago, Rob, and working with folks around research and advocacy, we finally got to a point where it's like, you know what, we really need to act. We need to put this into a platform, and we need to mobilize political action around this. And that's really it. Like, we need to mobilize political action around these issues that are going to impact communities of color. And we need to mobilize communities of color to come out to vote, not for the candidate that they, you know, like the best or they think says the right things, but the political candidate that is truly committed to moving policy forward that is going to impact their daily lives. So that is what we hope to do.
So are you active in the presidential campaign? Are you going to be active in congressional campaigns and state and local campaigns?
Yes, sir. I think the key pathway to this is, one, we need to get this on the presidential platforms of the major parties, which we're starting to do. So you see candidates like Elizabeth Warren has a housing plan that has housing and home ownership subsidies built into it. You have Bernie Sanders, who has a plan around universal healthcare, but also around debt-free college, which we didn't talk about, but would be a huge benefit to black and brown communities. You have a candidate like Kamala Harris, who has a plan to provide a universal basic income so that everyone basically is starting at the same place as far as income goes. And then you have the Democratic Party in the House passing a minimum wage bill that has been sent to the Senate, and you know, it'll be, hopefully at some point it'll be debated there. But in the end, we really need to build the political power behind these ideas, because ideas don't get passed unless there's a constituency for them. And that's what Liberation and Generation, working with groups like Fight for 15 in Florida and SEIU, hopefully we can do.
And the planks of the liberation economy, the ideas that you have, they're on your website?
Yeah, so right now, you can go to liberationinageneration.org and sign up for updates that we will be sending out on a regular basis around our work.
Well, Jeremy Greer, thanks for coming on WMNF. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, I'd just like to add that the time is now for us as people of color to rise up and really ask and demand of our public officials to pass forward economic policy that is going to be in our best interest. And we hope to see everybody out there on the campaign trail and at the polls come March and then later in November.
Jeremy Greer, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
All right, thanks a lot.
That's Jeremy Greer, who's co-founder of a group called Liberation in a Generation. He'll be part of a meeting tonight about minimum wage at the IBEW Hall on East Chelsea Street in Tampa, 6603 East Chelsea Street in Tampa at 6:30 p.m. That's organized by the group Fight for 15. Well, let's open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Kevin writes this regarding gun costs. He says the price of one of these killing machines is around the same as 1 ounce of quality cannabis, $350. Guns being this cheap makes one wonder why cannabis is so expensive and guns are so cheap, writes Kevin. Kevin, thank you for that. Let's go to Deanna, who's in Largo. Deanna, you called in a while ago. What would you like to say?
Hi, Rob. Well, the gun issue is so close to my heart, especially you told the story of the young man holding the gun and killing a friend with the gun.
Yeah, he killed his sister. Yeah, he killed his sister and then said his sister committed suicide, but he actually was mishandling the gun and killed his sister.
And, was in my family in, it's 1939, someone was showing a gun in one room that was supposed to, and I always, in quotation, say, air quote, an unloaded gun, and it killed my grandmother when my mother was only 9. So, and that was 1939, and still today, I never met her. Excuse me. This issue reeks my heart, just wrenches it. And so I would say that I would like, if they could, if they're manufacturing all these guns, there should be a green flag, a red flag, or whatever. This is loaded, it's not loaded. There should be, at this juncture, some indication that when you're touching a gun, that you know there's a bullet in the chamber would be ideal. Number two is warn your children. I have 10-year-old grandsons, and they are typical boys, and I had the conversation with them. If someone finds their father's gun, their uncle's gun, if you are in a room and a gun appears, do exit. Leave the building. If you can't get to a phone, you go to a safe neighbor, you call me. Do not stay in a room with the child showing you his father's gun. And I think that we need to really get this message out to our children that there are guns in people's houses. I have left parties because someone had a gun on a holster, on a hat rack. And I said, could you please put that away? And there were children at this party. He says, oh, no, it's my right not to. So, of course, I followed my own advice and left the premises. But to those out who are so adamant about their gun rights. I believe they have their right to gun. And I think I've told you this before. They need the one where you got to stuff the bullet in there, and then there would be no mass shooting. And I appreciate your time. I appreciate your show. And, you know, my mother was brought up to shit. My grandmother had 5 children in 1939. And, as I said, today I'm 64 years old, you know, and that still breaks my heart.
I can hear it in your voice. I'm so sorry to hear that story.
So, but I'm so glad, and thank you for the platform.
Thanks, Deanna.
That people need to hear this and what you have to say. And thank you so much.
Thanks, Deanna. Thank you. Thank you. Let's go to Susan in Lakeland. Susan, you're on WMNF.
Hi, Rob. I just wanted to, this is just a throwback to 2011. I'm sorry, 2001. I was working for a company, and both him and But the owner and the co-owner told me about that they were arresting terrorists, they did, in Polk County in Bartow, who were going to blow up the courthouse. So if anyone else has ever heard that, I would just like some confirmation or something, because at the time I told them it was crap. It was not true.
What was it on 9/11? Was it on 9/11? Yeah. And you heard that rumor that day?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And they were sure that those people were in Bartow to blow up the courthouse.
Well, there were a lot of rumors that day, Susan.
I know there were, but these guys lasted. I mean, they told me this over and over for several weeks, and it never showed up in the media, and I just wonder if anyone else ever heard this crap. And
well, I think
I'm so sorry for Deanna, and I didn't lose anybody, but it was a bad day for everyone.
Yeah, it sure was. Well, Susan, thanks a lot. I don't think that happened, but I'm sure the media, the Lakeland Ledger at the time, had a lot of reporters. So had that happened, I'm sure that the word would have gotten out. It's not something that the Lakeland Ledger would sit on, or the Tampa Tribune at the time. Both papers being pretty strong at the time in 2001. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Gino in Tampa. Gino, what would you like to comment about?
Two things, actually. The first thing is the Second Amendment. We know we harp so much on the Second Amendment. My understanding that the Second Amendment was actually really for the Europeans were afraid of slave uprising. And this is the main reason, if you Google a lot of things, it'll tell you that they were actually afraid of slave uprisings. And there's a reason why they kicked in the Second Amendment. That's what it got a lot of its power on. And the second thing I wanted to comment on is actually the redlining, what the guy was talking about, your speaker was talking about. Again, something that was actually done by America against blacks, and they know it was going on. It's nothing new. And a lot of people don't know about redlining, but those things are embedded and woven into the fabric of America. And if they haven't changed in all of these years, I doubt if they will. I'm not saying that sound like a pessimist to give up on that fight. But it's been going on. I'm 57. You know, that's been going on before I was born, and it will continue to go on.
Yeah, and Jeremy, I don't think my guest, Jeremy, my guest, wouldn't agree with you. I mean, that's why he's fighting for it. He wants to change things, and he wants to change things so that the next generation doesn't have to go through what the last 40 generations have had to go through. So, Gino, thanks a lot. I just don't buy into pessimism. Sorry. We can be pessimistic somewhere else, but not on this show. Gino, thank you. Let's go to Rob in Sarasota. Hey, Rob, you're on. What would you like to say?
Yeah. The rate of suicide from men to women is 3.54, and that's from AFSP.org. Okay. And removing guns or getting rid of guns or whatever, changing the Second Amendment, I mean, that's not going to change the fact that men are killing themselves 3.5 times for every one woman. And there's like 9 men in jail for every one woman. And we're not addressing the systemic problems. It's not shocking to me that your speaker is going to go speak at the National or whatever League of Women or whatever it is, because they're the ones who are going to benefit most from changing the Second Amendment. If women killed themselves 3.5 times, if women had an incarceration rate of 9-1, stuff would be done overnight. But we're not addressing the systemic issues that are the actual problems. I hope that the Second Amendment isn't changed until...
Well, he's not saying change the Second Amendment. He's saying that if you want to have so many guns in society, you should do a few things. One is require insurance from all gun owners. He has a whole list of things. He wants to regulate and license gun dealers. He wants increased oversight and regulation of gun manufacturers. He wants to provide financial incentives for people to give up their existing firearms. But none of this stuff is changing the Second Amendment. All this is regulations on guns. So he's not saying remove the Second Amendment. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And we'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for NOLA. He's coming up next. Carol Arenas has been our phone producer today. Thank you, Carol. And I'm Rob Loreith. This is WMNF in Tampa. Coming up next, the NPR News. And then Midpoint with NOLA for the next hour from 12:06 to 1 o'clock. This is WMNF.